This is a very special recording of the Catalpa Escape podcast series. Margot O'Byrne, as you'll all know, sitting here in the middle, has been narrating the podcast so beautifully. We get congratulatory letters from all around the world, as well as all around Fremantle in Australia. But today we are so pleased to have the great-grandson of Captain George Anthony, Jim Ryan, with us. Please welcome Jim.
Thank you.
You're all here because you know the story, and we're not going to tell you the story again, although I am going to ask Margot to give us a very abridged 30-second version to bring us all up to speed. But we are really quite anxious to think about some of the other things that happened. Who was this guy, George Anthony? How did he get into this, and what happened to him later? Before I throw to Margot, I just want to mention this small point. As I drove here today, along High Street, past the Emerald Isle Hotel, I thought to myself, it's not even 47 years into the new British colony of Western Australia when this happens. 1829, 1876, very short period of time. So bear that in mind when you think about all the strange and interesting things that happened. Ships going everywhere in the world. But there's a particular ship, of course, we're here to talk about. Margot.
Yes, thanks, Michael. And great to have you here, Jim. So we're talking about the Catalpa. You've all been listening to the podcast series, no doubt. So remember that it was James Wilson here in the prison in Fremantle who couldn't take it anymore and wrote to John Devoy in New York saying, please get us out of this tomb. It's a living tomb. Devoy then consulted with Boyle O'Reilly and others, found James Richardson, purchased a whaling ship, the Catalpa, found Jim's great-grandfather, Captain Anthony, and he and the crew sailed through the whaling fields of North Atlantic down to Bunbury and then met up with the operative here in Fremantle, John Breslin, and they had meantime been passing letters to the prisoners in Fremantle Prison, get ready, Easter Monday, we're out of here. Galloped down to Rockingham, hopped on the whaling boat, rowed out, met the Catalpa. The Stars and Stripes goes up when the British confront them. Captain Anthony says the rest, and they go to freedom.
It's unbelievable. When we finished episode 11 of the podcast series, I actually shook my head. I thought it was a given they'd get away. I can't believe they ever pulled it off. I really can't. But Jim, can we come to you straight away?
Great.
Did you know this story about the Catalpa as a sort of babe in arms? When did you find out about it? How old were you?
I was 7 when I found the materials, and that triggered my mom going, what are you doing, you know, kind of thing. And so she sent me to my grandfather, and he began telling me the story. By the time I was 8 or 9, I knew the story generally. As I got older, I wanted to learn more. And then as I got even older than that, like late teens, I decided to organize all of the materials that my grandfather had left or my great-grandmother had left in the attic so that I could find them if I needed to.
Well, tell everybody a little more about the items that you found.
Oh my gosh. Let's see, 3 podcasts later. Flags, lots of documentation. The bill of sale for the Catalpa that James Reynolds signed, the bills of sale when the Fenians got the ship back, they sold the ship back to Richardson and Anthony and Hathaway for $1 each. And I have notes, I have the original manuscripts to my great-grandfather's book and writings and letters. As well as things that as a kid I thought were pretty good. Ever heard of belaying pins? They're these pins that stick in the side of boats you can tie ropes to. I had a bunch of those. A sword. I could go on and on. It's just it was a tremendous thing for me because I think I was drawn to it. Not sure why, because I had a lot of other things I should have been doing, but I fell in love with that. And I loved it and kept going. I have his trunk, too, which I cherish, that I put the flags in and all the most important things, the bills of sale, and I keep it in his trunk.
So, Jim, what were the most interesting things that you found for you at that
time? I think the family documentation of how they lived, and like as a kid, I think the materials were great. You know, they can feel them, and you know, you can play with them and stuff. But when it came time to learning, it was learning about my family, learning about him, learning about my great grandmother and how she tolerated the fact that he was gone for so long. I read his book at least 6 times because it was just so interesting to me. But I think that's what it was. It was like the materials that educated me to be able to understand what was, I don't know, what was drawing him and why my family got involved. You know, why did my grandfather do this and somebody else's grandfather not do it, which is, you know, something as a kid I thought about. It's all those things that I think were really important to me.
Mm. Jim, back in those earlier times, you probably didn't know anything much about Fremantle. How did you come to learn about Fremantle? You've been here a few times now. What do you make of it all?
That's a great question. I think I knew about Fremantle only as a destination for the longest time. But here we go. I go to the Whaling Museum to go to a play a friend of mine, Dave Duggan, suggested I go to. It's called Cashman's Diary. And it was a musical. So I go and I walk around and look and I sit down. I bought a CD just because it was about the Catalpa. And I bought a couple of T-shirts because it was about the Catalpa. And then I listened to it for about 45 minutes. And then I was moved. I went down and I said to one of the men, I said, this was wonderful. He looks at me and he goes, this is Brendan Woods, of course. You know. He goes, what do you know about the Catalpa? I said, well, my great-grandfather was the captain. He goes nuts. He's calling all these friends down, and he has Peter Stevens, who wrote one of the book, he came down, and this guy, Mark from California, who was doing a video, came down, and they wanted to go to my house. And the first thing Brendan says before we leave is, you got any stuff? So naturally, I said, well, kind of, yeah. Well, we're going to your house tonight, right? And so we all drove to my house. Cindy, my wife, made kale soup for everybody, and I started bringing stuff down from the attic. And you know, as usual, Brendan was so excited. He was walking around. Peter Stevens is asking me questions. The first question he asked me, which was really interesting, was, "Why did he do it? He has no skin in the game. Why did? Because he was writing a book. He wanted to know more about my great grandfather." So I said, "Well, I can only tell you. This is my quote. I'll never forget it." I said, well, I can only tell you what my grandfather told me. He said it was the right thing to do. And that changed everything. For Brendan, he goes, oh, yeah. And then Peter Stevens put it in his book immediately and sent me the galleys about 2 weeks later to read it to make sure he did it right. And that's when I realized Fremantle was a real place. I mean, it was really amazing. That's how long it took me to understand this is a big deal. You know, and in New Bedford, am I talking too long?
No.
New Bedford is a place full of history. It's been the richest town per capita in the world twice in history. A big whaling town. When the whaling went down, they finally got into, you know, building factories, and the Industrial Revolution took over, and they made millions and millions of dollars that way. The Quakers were geniuses at making money, I have to be honest with you. And I think that over time, we went into a real stall, and that was in the 70s and 80s, where we lost a lot of jobs. A lot of jobs went south. And now New Bedford has picked up, and it's big into wind power. We are a place that ships wind turbines out to the ocean so that the company that's installing them can install them in the ocean. And that's been a big windfall for New Bedford.
We heard last night, and this expression is going to keep coming back, it's the right thing to do. Declan O'Rourke worked it into his latest song about the Catalpa, which was really quite nice, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
Jim, along the lines, have you discovered anything that surprised you in your search for the in your search of your family, the Anthony family?
Yeah. Thanks to my wife. She's really good with, you know, looking into families' histories, and she went back to the 1600s and found that both the Anthonys on the father's side and on the mother's side, how many people were first settlers in the United States, and how over time many of them became very successful. Many of them became very successful.
Well, and you can tell this is a live recording.
Yeah, we sure can. And as time went on, I realized by looking at my wife's work how much history there was in the family of seafaring people, mm-hmm. you know, and how many had drowned at sea, which is really interesting to me. George Anthony's dad, Humphrey, died at sea. He was 9 years old at the time. His older brother, Charles, was already at sea. He went to sea at 15. So when George turned 15, that seemed to be the ripe age when they're ready to go. He went off to sea and learned from different sea captains. And I have all the logbooks of all the boats that he was ever on, which was one of the other things that I found interesting. And I think that that helped him. And I think it helped him to figure out what he wanted to do. He fell in love with the sea, yet at the same time, he fell in love with his wife, and she didn't want him to go to sea anymore. And that was the moment that changed him.
Now, that's something that I think a lot of people have been able to resonate with. How old was Captain Anthony when he took this job on?
He was 31.
And he only recently got married, and there was a young child?
Yes. She was 4 months old. We checked it today, so make sure I got the right age.
So then you take into account that it wasn't always what you'd call a safe and secure job going to sea.
No.
You didn't always come back. She can't have been very happy about him going.
She was the daughter of John T. Richardson. John T. Richardson was so strong about his opinions, I think. And he really liked my great-grandfather. In fact, I think they were friends, and he was like a surrogate dad to my grandfather, and that's how he met his wife, who was Richardson's daughter.
And Richardson's your great-great-grandfather.
That's right.
We shouldn't leave him out of the family story, should we?
He was a very interesting man. I mean, ultimate businessman, because whaling ships, I was shocked at this too. Whaling ships were like, you build them, you use them up, you throw them away, you build another one. It's not like they don't like, you know, like the Susie Q that you keep forever. It's like, no, once this ship has run its course, sink it, take it apart, build a new one. And I think that was his mentality.
Just before we lose Richardson, you've got this marvelous flag.
Yeah.
It was unveiled at Cadogo a couple of nights ago.
Right.
Astonishing thing. Tell the audience, and we'll have a photograph when the podcast goes up, what that flag is, what its provenance is.
Sure, that's a great question. JTR, it's a big flag. It's like 15 feet long, maybe 8 feet high. And it hangs high, and it announces the owner of the boat. So these are used in port. If they, like in Bunbury, when the ship entered Bunbury, they would have raised that flag and kept it there along with the pennant that I also have, and other flags to dress the boat up to make it look fancy and nice. And then when they went back to sea, they take all the frivolous things down, like the JTR flag and the pennant and others, and they'd put the sails up and they'd go. So if the Catalpa was out 10 miles out waiting for the boat to come in to them, they would have had only sails. None of the other flags would have mattered.
Do you have any sense, before we leave Richardson for a little while, what he might have said to his son-in-law?
Ooh, good question. You want to finish the question?
well, I fear in the three quarters of the way through the 19th century, Richardson's daughter mightn't have been let into terribly much. But what do you think he said to Anthony to compel him to do this job?
Anthony, when he got married, now you have to understand, he's married to the daughter of a man who outfits whalers. So he loved whaling, but he decided, because he loved his wife, to take a land job. So he took a job working as a machinist in a place called Morse Twist Drill, which another New Bedford thing, they developed the first twist drill in all the world. So they were shipping them all over the place and making a lot of money. So he was a machinist doing that work. Numerous times he went to JTR and said, "I hate this. I need to do something different." And from what we read, Richardson says to him, "Wait a little while. I may have something for you." That was the quote. And I'm not sure what he meant by that, but I think down the road, Richardson had already talked to somebody and was, I don't think that DeVoy just showed up and in 24 hours Richardson says, "Are you going to meet my son-in-law?" And boom. I think there was some connection going on back and forth a little bit. And that's why Richardson said, "I may have something for you." I think DeVoy really impressed Richardson.
Well, he's lucky that Elon Musk wasn't his father-in-law. He might have found himself on a spaceship to Mars.
And I wonder then, your great-grandmother was Richardson's daughter.
Right.
So he knew his daughter, he knew his son-in-law. What do you think was going on for Richardson with his daughter, and what do you have any family history or oral history about what his daughter's response might have been?
This is my hypothesis, and I think it's pretty good. Richardson was a very strong personality, and I think he said to his daughter, "Listen, this man's going crazy. He needs to have something that meaningful to him." Mm-hmm. You got to understand, DeVoy. I'm sorry, I should be looking at them, right? DeVoy really impressed Richardson to the point where I think Richardson, being a Quaker, understood what the need was for these men to escape, because Quakers believe deeply that you help the person who's imprisoned for wrongful reasons. You support people who are in trouble. You're kind to people. You don't go to war. These are the kinds of values I think that Richardson had, and as well as I think my great-grandfather had them as well, because he was from a Quaker family also.
The Quaker connection's really interesting, isn't it? You've started to unravel it. Have you looked into that? I mean, there may be some Quakers amongst us here today.
I looked into it deeply, actually, to the point where my wife and I have talked about it. There's so many people in their background, I can't remember them all. If I look at them, I look at their names, I can remember them. But they went so far back, and to give you an example, John Anthony came to the country in the 1600s and lived in Boston, was probably an indentured servant for a while, and he ended up going to Rhode Island, and I'm not going to be as accurate as I want to be. I'm trying to remember the picture. But there was a problem in Boston where they were hanging Quakers. The Puritans who came on the Mayflower, escaping being abused by their country, began abusing people of other faiths. Everybody needed to be a Puritan. So Anthony's left with a group of people and went to Rhode Island where they could practice free religion. And Anthony was there, although he wasn't a signatory, when they had this thing called the Portsmouth Compact, which gave religious freedom to everyone. And Rhode Island was the place that prevented the Puritans from taking over all of New England, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and making it making Rhode Island a place that people could go if they wanted to practice their own faith.
So it's a deep, deep history of justice,
right?
Freedom, yes. To practice what you believe in,
right.
Doing the right thing, if you might
right.
say.
Yeah. And that's where, Richardson, Quaker, Anthony, Quaker, I mean, these, they believed in something.
Mm.
And I think, to me, that's that was important. You know, that's why I think it was an easy thing for Richardson to talk his daughter into this for that reason. You know,
okay.
It makes a lot of sense. There's shared values.
Yeah.
And everyone knows what's at stake.
Right. Mm.
I was wondering if there were any other, like, in the whole story, as you piece it together, are there any unsung heroes?
Ooh. We had, my wife and I had this huge discussion this morning about trying to figure out who would be a person that was involved with this that got almost zero credit and was impossible to replace. So we came up with William Foley.
Yes.
Well.
My favorite too.
William Foley keeps coming up in the podcast, and I need to be reminded because he's not one of the six, but he was here for a while.
Yes.
As a Fenian in the prison. But go ahead.
Do you want to talk about William?
You go ahead.
Okay. So this morning I read his whole life story because I really wanted to get a sense if he in fact was the kind of person that would be an unsung hero. And what I learned was this man struggled with his ethics about working for the British, fighting for the British, like the Catalpa Six did. They felt the same way. They wanted to do something against the British. William Foley had worked for and fought for the British for a number of years and eventually was given a job where he was like a man who supported the head of the British in Ireland. I forgot what his name was.
The Admiral General or something.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so what he started doing, and this is where I think he felt really good about himself, he was stealing stuff and sending it over to the Fenians. So they got a sense of what the British were thinking, what they were doing, and he eventually got caught. And like normally, I hate to say it normally, but somebody squealed on him. Mm. And he ended up getting on the Hougoumont eventually. He was in five prisons before he ended up getting on the Hougoumont and going over with everybody else to here, you know, in the prison. And because he wasn't considered an active soldier, he wasn't given the life sentence he was given, I think 10 years. I'm not sure, 10 or 7.
Yeah.
Or he did 7 or something like that.
Yeah,
and then he got a ticket to leave. And he was around and he made friends. He was very good about making friends with everybody. So he ended up being Breslin's guy to get into the prison and give notes to the guy. I think it was Wilson mostly, right?
Yeah.
To give notes to Wilson and giving notes back to Breslin. We don't think, looking at it, that it could have happened unless he was there, that Foley was irreplaceable.
He was the oil that made the whole thing keep going well.
Right. So, it's a sad story for him because just before the rescue, Breslin gave him money and told him to get out of town and go back to England or wherever he went. I think he went back to Ireland and and take care of himself. But then I think he went to London actually. And then he got really, I want to go back. He came back to New York.
Mm.
And when he got back to New York, he had gotten back just a few weeks before the ex-convicts showed up. And so he was there to welcome them.
Yeah.
But sadly, he developed a serious heart condition. And very shortly after the men came to New York, he died.
Mm.
But he was buried in a cemetery in New York. And the pallbearers were the six guys.
But there was another part of that too, is that when he left from Fremantle,
yep.
He went to London and then he went across to Dublin and he actually reported to the IRB in Dublin exactly what was happening here in Fremantle. So he was the carrier of the message here. He went, took about 2 or 3 days to go home to Tipperary, see his family, but then he realised that he wanted to be on the dock in New York when the Catalpa arrived.
Yeah.
And there's a lovely little footnote in Peter Murphy's recent book, is that after they arrived, of course they had no clothes or anything, they'd been in prison for years, that Gough went out and bought them all the Fenian Six from here, a new suit, and the next day, or was it Devoy perhaps who bought it? But the next day then comes another little name on the bottom, Will Foley, also got a new suit to parade through the streets of New York. So he was recognised very much as the a really important part of the Catalpa escape.
Jim, I mentioned earlier that I was surprised in the end, thinking it was a smooth operation to get these guys out on a whaleboat from Rockingham onto the Catalpa and back to New York, that it actually happened. I really came to the view they were dead lucky. Did you think there were some really surprising parts in the whole story when you worked your way through it?
This wasn't surprising, but it interests me, actually, that Tom Brennan had chased them all over the place to try to get to Fremantle. So he's involved with the break, you know, not generally. So he ends up at the beach with everybody else, and then this gentleman, Mr. Bell, comes down and says, "What are you guys doing here?" Brennan pulls out a gun and says to Anthony, "Do you want me to shoot him?" Anthony goes, "What are you, nuts? You don't shoot anybody here. We don't need to be, nobody needs to be killed here." And he actually, Anthony gave Bell some money and told him, you know, like, I don't know, just go out and have some fun. But he got on his horse and went right to the British. And that kind of surprised me. But other than that, I've heard the story so many times, it's hard to be surprised anymore.
Well, like Declan O'Rourke mentioned last night at the Fabulous concert, the bit that took my breath away was when the guy, the captain on the British vessel, that where he had been the captain of the Hougoumont those years earlier, meets up off South Africa in the Indian Ocean, and your great-grandfather goes across to his ship, and they sit down and have a rum or whatever they do, and
you got
swap maps, and it all happens. I mean, it just seems ridiculous. But you get the impression that people did this sort of thing in those days? Stop out in the middle of the ocean?
Oh, all the time. It was the way they got news, and especially the New Bedford guys. At one point, though, Holland, this childhood friend of his, where they were just outside of Flores, and he bumps into Holland, and so they call gamming. You know, when you gam, you go bet. One of the captains goes to the other boat, or vice versa, and they just talk. And so Holland says, "Listen, you want to make some big money in Flores? Go, you know, this." He said, "There's tuna everywhere around here. Just pull a bunch of tuna in. Go into Flores and sell it, and you'll have enough money to buy whatever you need." Well, he says, "Oh, that's a good idea." Naturally, good advice is hard to find. So they got maybe 1,000 pounds or more of tuna. And he gets a couple of boats and starts rowing them in to sell them. And the guy in Flores says, "You're under arrest." So he got arrested in Flores for stealing from Flores and not paying the duty on these fish. So he said, "I'll take them back." He goes, "Well, okay." Somehow or another, he talked the guy into taking him back, because I was surprised he didn't end up in the clinker, you know, in the jail. But he ended up rowing him out, making a sharp left turn, going around the island and dumping him in the water and going back to his boat and saying, "Yep, we're all set." That was interesting.
So in your last talk at the Buffalo Club, you mentioned interesting people that might have influenced Anthony make his decision to take the decision to take the rescue. Can you tell us about who were some of these people from your point of view?
His brother Charles Morgan Anthony. It's hard to tell you how close these people were, but Charles Morgan was named after a guy that built his own boat, Charles Morgan, in New Bedford, at the bottom of it, called the Hillman Street Boatyard. And this boat is the only living boat, well, not living, but it's the only remaining boat in all the world, a whaling boat. And it's in a museum in Connecticut. It's called the Charles W. Morgan. So Charles was 15 years old when he left. George was 9. Charles had an incredible history on the water, very different than Anthony's. He became a merchant sailor. Then he went into the Navy. Then he fought in the Civil War. He was part of the blockade that blockaded Charleston Harbor. He got all sorts of awards and ended up as a lieutenant commander before he retired. But he died young of kidney disease in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and is buried now in New Bedford. I think he had a lot to do with Anthony. When you think about it, if you look at the developmental piece, a 9-year-old kid looks up to his 15-year-old brother, and his brother moves on. Not only does he do whaling, but he also ends up fighting in the Navy, and I think that had a lot of, I think Anthony felt like, well, you know, I've got a lot to live up to here. After his dad had passed away or drowned, he's got John Richardson and he's got his brother. I think those were the biggest influences on his life.
Yeah.
You think that Richardson might have said, do this job and then you can go back to the land?
I don't think they thought that far. That's a really good question. I don't think they thought that far. I think it was going like, listen, this is a really important thing to do, and you do it, and we'll go whaling again, maybe.
So remind us, what does your great-grandfather do when he comes back from this epic?
Oh, great question.
From this epic tour. I mean, people come back from wars, my grandfather, those sort of things, and people just go back to their lives. He was a watercolor artist. Yeah. He went back to painting when he got back from New Guinea. So what does your great-grandfather do when he comes back, ties his boat up in New Bedford Harbour, yep, a little bit south of Boston, not far from Rhode Island? Does he go down and start catching fish or what?
He goes right back to his job as a machinist.
Oh, no.
Because he couldn't get any other work, you know? It's hard to explain. Well, this is what his life was, and now his professional life is over. He had to figure out what he's going to do next. And in comes Hathaway. And Henry Hathaway was a good friend of his. And Hathaway, by that time, I don't know, I don't want to go into detail, I'll get off topic, but Hathaway was that time gotten off whaling, and he was in the job of chief of police in New Bedford. They called it the night police because they didn't need a day police, I guess. So they had night police. And he got my great-grandfather a job as a policeman, which I think he also hated. Yeah, I really do. And he did that for 4 years. And after that 4 years, President Cleveland, the word must have gotten out or something, President Cleveland gave him a job working for the Customs Department. He ended up being a customs agent. What he did on that job was, his job was to go out to every ship that came in New Bedford, which there were tons, because we were considered one of the big ports in those days. And he would check their manifests, talk to them, get to know the captains, make sure they weren't trying to bring in any contraband. And then he'd go back in and do the paperwork. He did that for the rest of his life. He loved it. I read a bunch of his obituaries again while I was here, just to make sure I had my head on this. And everybody said how much he enjoyed his job, and how friendly he was, and how happy he was. And if it hadn't been for the fact that he had fallen backwards into the hold of a boat while he was checking their paperwork, and he was in the hospital for 4 months, then he came back and went back to his job. But his health, what it said was his health wasn't good, and he got sick with a cold, which quickly turned into pneumonia, and he passed away from the pneumonia in his home. Mm. But you know,
at what age, Jim?
69.
Wow.
Mm. There's some lovely obituaries that were written. You get the impression that your great-grandfather was really quite a gentleman, lived up to those ethics, if you like.
Yeah.
That were instilled in him through his Quaker faith.
Correct. I'm convinced of that. Everything I've read, and some of the obituaries are so nice, it's hard to believe. Mm. Kind, quiet, wasn't loud.
Mm. Well,
he was a good leader in that regard. This is what he taught me, that's why I get emotional. He taught me that to be a man, you don't have to be a loud bully to be a boss. You can be firm, clear, do what you gotta do, but care about people, be able to understand human behavior, and respect everybody. I think that's what he did. Even on the boat, I'm trying to think of it. He had the one guy that I'm surprised bolted in Tenerife was Bowles. He was this guy Bowles, he was a third mate. He was a Caucasian guy. And I think my great-grandfather was shocked by him. But other than that, like he would just, my great-grandfather goes out and says, okay, I need to get four more guys. So let's go to the bars and see if we can find more people. Very rational person. I'm trying to think of what else. But everything I've read about him talked about an unassuming, kind, caring person, gets along with everybody. Surprising. One of the obituaries says, how could the guy like this do such a thing like that? Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm. And yet in the moment,
right.
He was able to be so absolutely grounded, and particularly in that moment on the whaling boat when they were leaving Rockingham Beach, the storm came up, they couldn't find the catalpa, they saw her, they couldn't get to her. And obviously that 16 of them in that, if you go outside and have a look at the tiny little whale boat that's upstairs here, 16 people in that, and he managed to keep those people who were quite distressed,
right.
I imagine, but he kept them calm.
Yep, right.
What a presence of mind. Eh?
I think it was natural for him. I don't think it was something he learned. You have to be calm to keep other people calm.
Yeah.
You know? You have to make decisions that let everybody know that you're in control and that we're going to make it okay, even if you're not.
And then later on, he said to his biographer, I wouldn't have given a dime for all of our lives that night.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Well, when you consider the mast broke and they had to cover themselves with the sail so that the Georgette wouldn't see him or other police boats.
Mm.
Nutty stuff.
John Gough was the lawyer who was mixed up in the early days with Devoy to get the whole rescue happening and raising the money.
Yeah.
He and Devoy seemed to have not got on forever. Gough went on and became a judge of the New York Supreme Court and wrote a quite lovely eulogy, really, to him. There's a bit here I just read out. Striking the manacles from the limbs of these prisoners chained to penal servitude for life, he did an act worthy of a Homer's song, and his splendid defiance of arrogant British naval power should be a monument to American seamanship as long as the Stars and Stripes fly the ocean. It was more than just this personal heroism, wasn't it? He stood for something big in America.
The fact that he impressed Gough tells me a lot about him. Gough was tough to impress. He was a very rational, very strong personality.
So what does it tell you, Gough's praise?
It tells me it's very real. He wouldn't write it if he didn't believe it. Mm. I'm convinced of that. Because Gough really had, as you understand, Gough and Devoy had a real fight over stuff. And Gough, the fact that Devoy and Gough were both in my great-grandfather's side tells you that they were both impressed with him for different reasons.
Mm. And did he remain friends with Devoy? Do we know?
Yes. Oh. Yes. In fact, at one point, Devoy wanted to come and after there was a gathering somewhere in Hartford or something. My great-grandfather went down to give a speech, and Devoy couldn't go because he was too sick. But I have the quote, I think he said, my dear friend or something like that, I'm sorry, I can't come, but my friend so-and-so will read a speech I've written.
Isn't life interesting? You can't plan these sorts of things. They just happen.
Yeah.
You can try and work out the chain of events which led to the ultimate catalpa rescue just south of Fremantle here. And yet, you know, if it weren't for the letter from the tomb, if it weren't for Devoy then getting passionate about it, but ultimately finding Richardson. Richardson seems to be the link man. I want to come back to Richardson. He seems to know exactly the right person for this job. It might never have happened for your great-grandfather, but it did, and he had this great opportunity in life, and he acquitted himself amazingly well.
You said it exactly like the obituary. Impressive. Mm. You remembered that. I think also Henry Hathaway needs to have some credit here because he was smart enough to send him to Richardson, that he thought Richardson was the man to go to.
Yeah.
When O'Reilly wrote that letter of introduction for Devoy and James Reynolds to meet with Henry Hathaway, Hathaway didn't want to talk to him until he read the letter. He was gruff, and he took the letter and he went to another room and read the letter, then came back and was friendly to them.
Mm.
Well, Wilson's the man.
Yeah.
Right. Now, everyone also wants to know, it'd be nice to have the Catalpa, the bark Catalpa, hanging next to Australia too in the Maritime Museum here, wouldn't it? What became of it?
As I said earlier, whale boats were meant to be used up and thrown away. Interestingly enough, this is new information I've never told anybody, but they held on to the Catalpa after it came back. The Fenians sold a Catalpa back to Richardson, Hathaway, and Anthony for a dollar each. And they used it for 4 years before they sold it. And it was sold to another group of New Bedford people who sailed it for another 2 years. And then it was sold, what they said, at the end of the, I have the whole history of the Catalpa, and at the end of it, it said, foreign sold. So in other words, they sold it to somebody from another country, they came and got it, and I don't know what they did with it, but it didn't last very long. They scuttled it in Honduras, I think it was.
I just say it was just another whaling ship, and
yeah.
People do their business.
Didn't mean anything to them.
Life goes on. Jim, we're getting towards the end of the podcast.
Wow.
But you've become, and Cindy, who we should acknowledge, where are you, Cindy?
Mm.
Who's assisted you, Jim, in all of this research. The two of you have become so involved in this. Here you are in Fremantle. We've all loved having you here. People organising the Fenian Festival have just loved having you here. But for the two of you, what has this event, this opportunity to discover things about your great-grandfather and your great-great-grandfather meant?
I have to say, what we discovered mostly was how wonderful the people here are.
Oh, you'll be invited back.
But it's true. I mean, the people, they've bonded to this story. And not only that, they're very kind to us. You know, it's like been a great experience in that regard.
Mm.
And it helps me to feel like this event really mattered here. It matters to the Irish community in New Bedford, but New Bedford has got so much history. I mean, going back to, I'm just telling you this, so much has happened in New Bedford that it's hard to fit it all in. So all the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick have an event every year to celebrate the Catalpa. It can be short, can be long, doesn't matter. In 1975, we flew the JTR flag on the flagpole in front of the Clerk of Deeds building to celebrate. So yeah, that's what I think, that's why I want to share Captain Anthony with all these people and everybody.
It's great that you do. I still can't believe that people, not just around Fremantle, but around the country,
yeah,
including Western Australia, don't really know enough, if anything, about the Catalpa. It's one of the great stories.
Well, we were talking to, was it Frank last night, about how few people in Ireland know the story too.
Yeah. And then last night we had the wonderful concert with Declan O'Rourke.
Yes.
And for people who weren't there, so Declan O'Rourke, one of Ireland's foremost singer-songwriters, came and gave a concert here last night. Just out of the blue, sang a song that he had written in the last 4 days while he's been in Fremantle and dedicated the song to Jim. So it's a song about the Catalpa and getting away and doing this. So I think it's really important. Your visit here has made a difference to us because your presence has brought the story alive. The research that you and Cindy have done is just fantastic. I mean, Michael and I have been searching through books for the last 12 months, getting bits and pieces, but now this just makes it really living history.
Well, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. And then that together, in New Bedford, people in Ireland and people here, we are the custodians of this story.
That's right.
And we are the ones who can actually keep taking it to others. I want to acknowledge Sean Roach over here, who's been telling this story for many, many years, long before we did, and Brendan Woods as well, that now the gravitas that we've been able to give it through your visit and through Declan O'Rourke coming and writing songs that are going to go to the world, we're actually continuing to pass this song on and through the podcast too.
Mm. And Mike and Joy Lefroy have just brought their fabulous book out. And the play was on the other night, a number of you will have been at. We weren't planning a big Q&A, but is there someone desperate to get an answer to a question?
Hi. Jim, yourself and Cindy have carried this legacy of your great-grandfather, and I know you have children and grandchildren yourselves, and I was having a quick chat with Cindy last night. So can you talk a little bit about this marvellous legacy that I think will not die with you and Cindy, but will continue and perhaps continue the relationship between New Bedford and Fremantle?
Now, not everybody might have heard that. There's no mic recording it, but the legacy amongst your own family and maintaining these connections.
I'd like to answer that, because I think what we're doing is Monday, tomorrow, I'm taking my artifacts to the jail, and they're going to digitize all of the information.
So that's Fremantle Prison, yeah.
Yes.
I've got some information I'll give to you later. But you might know that in Fremantle, they built a first replica of Endeavour and then a replica of Dovekin. How about
I think people can hear me anyway. How about building a replica of the Kadampa?
The question, because that mightn't have been recorded either, was, is it time to have a replica of the Catalpa in Fremantle with the other boats we've had at different times?
I think that'd be a great idea. The reason I'm agreeing with you is because they've been talking about that in New Bedford for years, the Irish community. But it's pretty expensive to build boats now.
We have physical skills in Fremantle to do it.
There you go.
Yes.
Hi, I want to jump to the enemy here. I'm most interested to know what were the repercussions of the British like the governor of the... does anybody know anything about that? Were they fired? Were they sent back? Were they whipped? No.
The question, if you couldn't all hear it, was, what happened to the authorities here who shouldn't have let them get away? Listen to episode 13, it'll be. there is a bit written on it. There were inquiries, as you might expect, and I'm sure they were already thinking about that as they were coming back on the steamer into Fremantle after the Catalpa was sailing off into the sunset. Anything else before we finish that you're desperate to hear an answer to from Jim? Yes.
Any great myths that you've had to lay to rest about the ship?
That's a great question.
Are there any facts that need to be...
That aren't facts?
Any popular myths that need exploding?
In all honesty, all I remember in New Bedford, the story has always been everything was happy on the way back. You know, they all partied and had cocktails at night and stuff like that. But it was a tough coming back to the States. The Fenians men were obviously traumatized. They weren't getting along with John Breslin. My grandfather had to step in a couple of times. Related to, they were upset. The whole deal was it was supposed to go whaling on the way back to make extra money to pay for the trip. And that's what they were about to do. And what happened was, and the guy said, no, you're not going to go. We're going. And they had guns, right? So it's like, we're not going to go. We're going home. And so Breslin wrote him. I have a letter that they wrote to the captain and Breslin. And Breslin's comments were, the food's fine. The water's fine. Your health is just as good as when you came, when you came on board. There's no excuses here. And so Anthony and Breslin went to his cabin and talked a bit. And Anthony walked out and told Sam Smith, he says, we're going home.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you join with me and Margo to thank our special guest, Jim Ryan.
Thank you.